I do love Bull, and I you know, it's like years since I've returned to it, but I feel like he's always sort of there.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, Peter Orner and I discuss The Death of Elsa Baskalite by Heinrich Böll. And stay tuned for a bonus discussion about another Heinrich Böll story, Parting. On this podcast, where we celebrate the short story, we were bound to get around to Heinrich Böll. What took us so long? He is a master of the 20th century short story. He was prolific. He was German and chronicled World War II, the bleakest of post-war years, but also the rebirth and prosperity of that country over the next three decades. His themes can be rather bleak, about the hypocrisy of governments, about alienation, but in his short stories he also endowed his characters with a sense of dignity and of an understanding that they deserve good things in this life, in fact, want those things for themselves. Böll was considered one of the greatest German writers, and he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1972. We see in his stories the need he felt to center the moral duty of writers to address social and political issues of their time. But like all of the great masters of the short story, his stories are for all time, even today, especially so for us lonely voices. In the story The Death of Elsa Baskalite, the protagonist describes the rather neglected neighborhood where he grew up. Mr. Baskalite was a grocer, and he puts on as if he has no patience for the children who run around making noise. He grunts and complains, but he gives them apples to eat. The protagonist is taken with the nightly view he has of the grocer's daughter, Elsa, clad in green and pirouetting at the window. He's entranced. Soon he comes to see that the neighbors don't like what they see. There's something vulgar or unseemly that they find in her dancing. The boy's family leaves the neighborhood. A war comes, a long one, and on the occasion of his return to the old building as an adult, he learns of Elsa's death. What happens next is an echo or homage to Chekhov's story, Misery, but Böll's story must be taken on its own. My own belief is that this particular situation of a parent losing a child is so beyond imagining, so beyond language or words, it can only be articulated as a story in a fiction for the rest of us to understand what it means to be bereft, what it means to lose almost everything and let that loss color every interaction from now on. Peter Orner and I also discuss Parting by Heinrich Böll. Maybe we've all had this kind of situation with someone, a friend or loved one or lover, where we've said our solemn goodbye and braced ourselves for the parting. But then we're still standing around together, standing at the gate or the platform, or maybe the car won't start. We keep on saying goodbye, keep kicking at the ground, keep making small talk as if we've just met, only occasionally dipping back into ancient history, remarking on a happier moment, a shared laugh, a secret, a time when saying goodbye didn't even seem like the final chapter we'd ever have to write. Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss The Death of Elsa Baskalite and Parting by Heinrich Böll.
I don't think anyone could argue that these stories represent Böll's best work, and yet they are ingrained in my brain, especially Parting, but now a story that I kind of discovered more recently, The Death of Elsa Baskalite. I don't know, if you can write these, you can kind of do anything. And I think we know from Heinrich Böll's career that he did a lot of other things. Extraordinary things. The novel The Clown, Billiards at Half Past Nine, I think that's the right title, right? Death of Katerina Blum, you know, amazing novels. But these stories, I meant to look up exactly when they were written. They, you know, some of his stories are early, you know, pretty much right after the war, but others I think were memories of the wartime written later. And I don't know where these exactly fit, but I will reach for Böll at a time like right now, when I am feeling utterly despairing, you know, and I'll read Böll and it's not like I'm going to feel better, but I'm going to know that, you know, his people survived a lot. And, you know, he was a German soldier in World War II is an odd fit, and yet he's one of my all-time favorites.
I think The Death of Elsa Baskerville was published in 1951 or thereabouts. But I want to ask you a question about this idea of why do you say if he can write this story, he can do anything? What is it about the story?
I think he stares something in the face so directly, and I think a lot of writers would attempt to, I think rightly, do more with a story like this. But I think Bull knew that in this case, there wasn't anything more to do. When we talked about this a while back, I compared it to Chekhov's Misery, which I think is a kindred spirit to this story. Guy whose son dies and he's telling the horse because no one will listen. This is Bull's Misery, I think. And I think that he just got it done. I mean, the story is over in a blink. And it's like you see Elsa dancing, and then, years pass, the war happens. Our narrator is a truck driver. He overhears somebody in the warehouse saying, "Hey, that Baskerville Light guy wants purple grapes." And he's like, "Oh, right, that's the guy with the daughter who lived in the courtyard where I grew up." And then the story is over almost. And we'll get to what happens after that point. But it's so compressed. And I can imagine, people thinking, "Hey, Heinrich, you could extend that one and really kind of make these characters more fully fleshed and give it more life." And Bull did that in other places, but here he was like, "You know what? I'm gonna write my misery."
There is this thing about the first part of it that establishes, as you say, in a very compressed way, so much about him and his family and the way that they were living, but also how he engaged with Baskerville. And he does it in a very short space. And we know that Baskerville was, this character there in that building that would throw out the garbage, and he was just this guy. The smell of rotten fruit was everywhere. He sets it up in a kind of a negative way. And then he says, but in his heart of hearts, Baskerville was a cheerful man. We knew as surely as only children can know that his grumbling was the game, even the way he used to swear at us. And he would often come up the three or four steps leading from the basement to the street with his pockets full of apples and oranges, which he tossed to us like rubber balls. So in that first paragraph, we learned so much about how his family was living, where they were living, but also that Baskerville is kind. And then immediately we learn about Elsa. But the interesting thing about Baskerville, as if that weren't enough, was his daughter Elsa, of whom we knew that she wanted to be a dancer. Perhaps she already was one. And here's the thing I wanted to ask you. I've been wanting to ask you about this story. I have two places marked off. One of them is in the yellow rectangle of the window frame, her thin green-clad body, her pale strained face, and her fair head that sometimes, when she jumped, touched the naked light bulb, which began to swing and for the space of a few seconds expanded the yellow circle of light on the gray courtyard. Did you or did you not underline that in your copy?
100%, 100%, and that is Bull at his most, And I mean, could you argue that this story is like sentimentalized or I don't know what, But the light in that paragraph, Bull, even when he might be kind of on his way somewhere, and this story's over in 3.5 pages, right? He still gets in a description like this. I could watch from my bedroom window when it got dark, and then semicolon in the yellow rectangle of the window frame, her thin green-clad body, her pale strained face, and her fair head that sometimes when she jumped touched the naked bulb, which began to swing and for the space of a few seconds expanded the yellow circle of light on the gray courtyard. Absolutely, it's beautiful. The imagery is beautiful. It's not what the story's about, but in a way it centers why this memory is so important to our truck driver.
And he does it just there because what we know about Elsa in the later years is that she wanted to be a dancer, and we see her. We also see the disdain of the neighbors who all can also see her through the window, but don't like what they see. They equate her being dressed that way and dancing around as, a very negative thing. They call her a whore, and the boy doesn't know what that means.
Can I read that? Because it's
Yes.
there were some people who shouted across the courtyard, "Whore," and I didn't know what a whore was. There were others who shouted, "It's disgusting." And although I thought I knew what disgusting was, I couldn't believe it had anything to do with Elsa. Then Baskerville's window would be flung open, and in the steam of the kitchen, his big bald head would loom up, and with the light that fell upon from the open kitchen window into the courtyard, he would pour out into the courtyard a torrent of oaths of which I didn't understand a single one. At any rate, Elsa's window was soon provided with a curtain, heavy green plush, which let out hardly any light at all. But every evening I would gaze at the faintly glowing rectangle and see her, although I couldn't see her. Elsa Baskerville in her light green tights, thin and fair haired, hovering for a few seconds on end under the naked light bulb.
The idea of the color green is interesting to me because the color of ballet is baby pink. And I feel like she's just trying so hard, to pursue this interest that she has that's maybe a little bit more refined than what her family is all about. And there she is trying, day after day, dancing in front of the window. And the others can't even appreciate it. They don't have an appreciation for it, so they just think it's, vulgar or something. And he keeps watching. Then there's a time shift from that paragraph that you just read to the next one. But before long, we moved away. I got older, found out what a whore was, thought I knew what disgusting was, saw dancers, but liked none of them as well as Elsa Baskerville, of whom I never heard again. We moved to another town. War came, a long war. And I thought no more of Elsa Baskerville. I didn't even think of her when we moved back to the old town. So, talk about compression. A lot happens, even a war, a long war. And of course, he never thinks about her, but he does move back. And he tried many jobs and he became a truck driver. And then, as you said before, the name Baskerville comes back into the picture and the idea of purple grapes. And so he is going to go on one of these deliveries, and even though he has no business doing it, goes back to the old neighborhood.
Yeah, it's almost cheesy. I mean, like, you forget about somebody and some incident in your childhood, and then many years later, after a long war, you overhear somebody in a warehouse talking about someone having ordered purple grapes, Baskerville's name, he hears it. And so, there's this, kind of real easy cause and effect. Oh, right, Baskerville, his daughter Elsa. And then, and then as you say, it sets up this idea that he goes back to Baskerville's store, which is in the courtyard that he grew up in. It's so simple, and yet, what happens in the store is also extraordinarily hard to forget. This is not a story that I will forget. I've been carrying around Bowles Collected forever and ever, and for some reason, and I always look to the shorter pieces of any collection. I read those first just because I don't know, maybe I don't know why. I just want to see that sense of compression, in action, and because I love it. But for some reason, I overlooked this story. I don't know why. And so then when I read it recently, I was like, damn, that's it. And what happens in the store is one of those things that happen in some stories that you never forget. And that's where I'm at with this one.
What the name evokes for him is the rectangular, brightly lit frame of the basement window. That's the imprint. When somebody says the name, and that's the imprint, is that window. That I can believe. That I think is not che that cheesy. And he sees Elsa Baskerville dancing, thin and pale, dressed in bright green. And so he takes a different route from the one he was supposed to take. His return to that neighborhood is also very striking because even though it wasn't like a great place before, now it's war torn and it's pretty well devastated. And he sees a child in the street which used to swarm with children, a pale, dark-haired boy sitting on a bit of broken wall, and drawing lines in the whitish dust. He looked up as I drove by, but then let his head droop again. And so he goes into Baskalites. You know, he enters into this space that, again, is, you know, it's pretty run down. There's dirt, there's dust, and there's this big barrel of vinegar. And, you know, it's just a very sort of, the details are very negative. And there's a woman there by the counter. And, you know, his thing is to say, my daughter has died, Elsa. And she says, I know. I've known that for 5 years. I need some scouring powder, too. My daughter has died, said Baskalite. He looked at the woman as if it had just happened, looked at her helplessly. But the woman said, the loose kind, a pound. And Baskalite pulled out a black barrel from under the counter, poked around in it with a metal scoop, and with his trembling hands conveyed some yellowish lumps into a gray paper bag. My daughter has died, he said. The woman said nothing, and I looked around. All I could see was some dusty packages of noodles, the vinegar barrel, which had a dripping tap, and the scouring powder, and an enamel sign showing a grinning fair-haired boy eating a brand of chocolate that hasn't existed for years. The woman put the bottle into her shopping bag, stuffed the scouring powder in next to it, threw a few coins onto the counter, and as she turned round and walked past me, she tapped her forehead briefly with her finger and smiled at me, as if to say, you know, this guy's lost his mind.
Right.
The details there are just the details. Like, they're not imbued with any amount of emotion necessarily, except for that line about, you know, he looked like it had just, like, he, like she had just died and he looked so helpless. But the rest
right.
of it is just the detail of this woman hearing the story for the millionth time and going about her business, not paying attention to him saying it over and over again.
Yeah, and she probably comes there every day. So
yeah.
You know, what is she going to do? You know, again, it's like in a lesser writer or somebody who was just kind of trying to drive a point home. I mean, this story would falter, I think. And so I think there's something pretty delicate about it. And I do think one false move, including where he gets pretty close to, you know, kind of a too easy thing, hearing the purple grapes, remembering the light. Even that, you know, for me, it gets dangerously close to, you know, kind of a too easy a segue into another part of the story. But I'm willing to forgive anything here when I get, he evidently did not know how to manage the spigot properly. The sour fluid ran over his fingers and down on the floor. A puddle had formed, a rotting, sour-smelling place in the wood, which squeaked under his feet. Now, Baskalite has been a shopkeeper for a long time. He knows how to get vinegar out of the big bottle, right? So it's complete muscle memory combined with indifference. And, you know, he doesn't care if he gets the vinegar in the bottle or not. All he cares about is turning to this old woman who is there to get the vinegar to tell her again that Elsa has died. And that's all that he says in the story over and over and over again. And we realize we learn from the old woman, it's been 5 years of this. So yeah, he's clearly lost his mind. And the grief has become this repetition. You know, it's what do you say? What do you say?
Well, two things. The sign, the fair-haired boy eating a brand of chocolate that hasn't existed for years.
Yes.
That's great. Such a great detail. I mean, it just shows, that one detail just shows how much time has passed. And this kind of, he's the ghost going through the motions, the muscle memory. He's not there. You know, it's like he really is just not living anymore. And the next paragraph that starts with, I thought of a lot of things, that's the second paragraph that I marked that I thought, oh, I bet Peter was going to talk about this paragraph. Can you read the paragraph that starts with, I thought of a lot of things?
I thought of a lot of things. Thought of the days when I had been so small that my nose was still below the edge of the counter. But now I could look without effort over the glass showcase bearing the name of a biscuit company and now containing only dusty packets of breadcrumbs. For a few seconds, I seemed to shrink. I felt my nose below the dirty edge of the counter, felt the fennings for candies in my hand. I saw Elsa Baskalite dancing, heard people shouting across the courtyard, whore, and it's disgusting, till I was roused by Baskalite's voice. My daughter has died. He said it mechanically, almost without emotion. He was standing by the showcase now, looking out into the street. "Yes," I said. "She is dead," he said. "Yes," I said. He turned his back to me, his hands in the pockets of his gray smock, which was stained. And again, it's like, this could be cheesy, and maybe some people might believe it so. She loved grapes, the purple kind, but now she's dead. He did not say, "What would you like?" or "May I help you?" He stood near the dripping vinegar barrel beside the showcase, saying, "My daughter has died, or she is dead," without looking at me. Again, I feel like I can't argue with it. You know, I'm just there.
I just love what he does with the spaces, like the window, the rectangular window, the light, and then with the showcase, the idea of his nose, you know, on the edge of it, on the edge of the counter. I mean, that he remembers that feeling, you know, it just shows how often he did it when he was a kid, how much a part of this place he was. And, you know, and only that. And that's such a simple idea, almost inconsequential. And yet this is what he's focusing on in that moment. This is the imprinted memory of the past. Such a simple, unlikely thing. He says that his daughter died. Baskelite says that Elsa died something like 8 times. I think I circled or counted 8 times. Because then another woman comes in and it's the same deal with her, except her reaction's a little bit different from the previous person, the previous customer. So he's just standing there agreeing, yes, she died. Yes, your daughter has died. And then he comes sort of out of that reverie. This woman is standing there and he says, my daughter has died. The woman said, yes, and began to cry and said, some scouring powder, please, a pound of the loose kind. And Baskelite went behind the counter and poked around in the barrel with the metal scoop. The woman was still crying when I left. I want to ask you, what do you make of that?
I think what rescues the story from its maybe easiness or I don't know, is the specifics. Also the fact that to me, both of these women are regular customers. One of them continues to cry every time she comes in, but she's also there for the scouring powder. You know, she's not there to share the grief with Baskelite, but that's maybe something that just happens in addition to the fact that she's there for the scouring powder. And, you know, like the other one's there for the vinegar. And I guess I see or I read into the interactions that Baskelite, this father, has with these women as being sort of routine, but also being somehow like they're communicating something beyond the fact of his daughter not surviving the war. You know what I mean? You know, I assume in a city like this, there are probably other shops. You know, they continue to buy from Baskelite, maybe out of pity, but also, you know, out of convenience because they probably live right there or whatever it is. They show up every day is how I see it. And to me, it makes the story all the more devastating because, and I think Bull excels at this. His people are not important. His people are people who were caught up in the madness, you know, not important, to people who think they're important. They are important. They're important to us. I think he, you know, his thing was how do people survive or not survive? But his narrators are often these people who are so damaged by the war and the consequences of it that there's nothing other to do than other than figure out how you're going to get through the next hour, you know? And I see all these characters as doing that.
I don't know if we want to read the last paragraph, but it really is so important to understand, at least for me, to understand why the imprint of Baskelite was really so important. It wasn't just Elsa. It was Elsa, but not just Elsa.
I mean, before we read it, I mean, there's almost this danger throughout this story that's too neat. You know, and I don't know how, I can't really explain why I think this story isn't too neat, but I think there could be an argument to be made, you know, and again, not arguing that this is even close to Bull's best work. That's the weird thing about this. Like, I think it's going to be a story I'm never going to forget. I probably said that way too many times on this podcast, but this one, I mean, that's, I guess this is what we do here. We talk about these stories that we're never going to forget, you know? And that doesn't mean it is the most brilliant piece of work ever. The shards of brilliance here, of the details, you know, you're in the hands of somebody who knows what they're doing, you know? And Heinrich Böll was never screwing around, you know? You know, he was a pretty serious man. He was very involved in politics throughout his life. He was head of Penn, President Penn, did a great deal for writers and for, you know, helping writers in need, especially. So he was one of the greats, I think. His humanity is sometimes so raw and stark that it may feel too easy. And I think that this story dangerously comes close to that. Do you feel that way? Do you feel that it? Do you feel that there is sort of like a, almost like the story kind of, especially at the end, maybe kind of rounds itself out into a nice little package?
I mean, I totally understand this idea of how neatly it ends and how that can be interpreted as too easy, cheesy, all of that. It's just too neat, it's too tidy. And yet I feel like, well, if it's gonna end, let it end there. You know, I still feel that way about it.
I would just say, like, you know, what he is always after, it seems to me, in the work of his that I've read, is trying to find the decency. That's how the story ends. It ends on a bit of decency, you know, more than that. It ends on an act of generosity that echoes Baskerville giving the fruit at the beginning of the story to the kids in the neighborhood, even though he growled and grumbled. You know, he's kind of ogre with a heart of gold kind of thing. You know what I mean? Again, we're not going very far into these characters. That's all I'm saying. You know what I mean? And yet, you know, I think we're always after, like in this show, like where you feel something, you know? And that to me is the whole point. The story like stab you in the heart. If yeah, if it you don't have a heart if it doesn't. The pale, dark-haired boy who had been sitting on the bit of broken wall was standing on the running board of my truck, looking closely at the dashboard. He reached in through the open window and raised the right and the left indicator. That's gorgeous, right? He's just playing with, you know, he's some kid. It's there, you know, it's 5 years after the war, and yet, you know, there's been very little rebuilding at this point, right? I mean, remember what the Allies did to these German cities, and this is one of them, and Bull is one of the great chroniclers of the aftermath of the firebombing. Not to be all pedantic and professorially, but W.G. Sebald credits Bull in one of his early novels that was unpublished initially, in being the only German writer of his time who stared in the face of what happened with the firebombing. And so, sorry to get off track, but I just love that idea of the kid just reaching in through the open window and raising the right, then the left indicator. The boy jumped when I suddenly stood behind him, but I grabbed him. That's also wonderful, right? The boy jumps, I grab him. You know, the kid doesn't know what's going to come next. Looked into his pale, frightened face, took an apple from one of the cases on my truck, and gave it to the boy. He looked at me in amazement when I let him go, in such amazement that I was startled. And I took another apple and another, stuffed them into his pocket, shoved them under his jacket, a lot of apples before I got in and drove off.
I like that he was startled. I like that this person is startled by the boy's look.
Yeah, it just adds so much complexity to that moment because, again, on its surface, it's simple. It's too easy. Oh, he sees Baskerville and he's reminded of Baskerville's generosity when he was a kid, and he's also grieving for Baskerville's daughter, who he kind of loved as a kid, and so he gives out the apples. That's not it. It's a more complicated thing. First, he scares the hell out of the kid, and then he himself is startled into doing that action. Like it's an incredibly complex moment, and that's why it is free, I think, of, you know, the charges that I'm sort of like, you know, kind of dancing around are possible, you know. And I think maybe someone reading it quickly might feel that way and move on to the next story. But if you take some time with this one, Again, it'll take your head off. So you want to talk about parting as a bonus?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean this is one of my all-time favorite stories.
Tell me why.
The opening line. We were in that bleak, miserable. Now I'm just riffing off it because I can't find it. We were
Oh.
in that bleak, miserable moment when the
No.
train has been announced to go but hasn't left yet. That's my paraphrasing, but the actual line
Wow, that's very close.
is 284. Sorry. I've taped this book back together a number of times. The binding broke years ago. We were in that bleak, miserable mood that comes when you have already said goodbye but can't part because the train hasn't left yet. Who hasn't experienced that?
I
You've
know.
said goodbye, you don't want to part, but the train hasn't left yet. I mean, it doesn't have to be a train. You know what I
Right.
mean?
Yeah.
It can be so many other things, but we were in that bleak, miserable mood that comes when you have already said goodbye but can't part because the train hasn't left yet. That is why, and that is the only reason why, aside from the fact that he yells at his leg, why this story is one of, is like in the pantheon for me. It just is. And reading it again, a little bit ago, it's less than 3 pages. Still kind of shatters me. I don't know. What do you think of it?
I've been thinking about this story a lot. I've been thinking about how this could be a very, I don't want to say ordinary moment, but it could be a very a situation that people are familiar with and they may not be used to seeing in a story or acknowledging that it happened to them, that some that they understand this particular kind of parting because they were involved in this kind of relationship. It captures something, like you said before. Very specific, very particular. And then the rest of it is, right, he's painting the scene. It's not a great place. The station was like all stations, dirty and drafty, filled to its vaulted roof with vapory haze and noise, the noise of voices and railway coaches, people coming and going. And the fact that you say goodbye to somebody and they're still standing there in this terrible place, it's almost like you can just go on about your life post-parting. You know, you're sort of like wanting to feel the emotions of that absence, distance that's about to come, the very act of parting, and you can't even move there. You know, the person's still standing there. It captures a very particular moment and situation that I don't necessarily think I've read before with this level of specificity, you know, that somebody could look at it and say, wow, he really captures this. Very particular kind of moment with very particular characters, and you're still sort of outside of it and getting something else out of it, I think. Does that make any sense?
Totally. And I'll just add to that the fact that just to add the layer of the specificities, this is about an ex-soldier who's now 30. So again, we are 5, 6 years out from the war, possibly. And there's a woman he loves, and we don't know what their connection has been in the past, but he loves her. We know that. And she loves him. We know that. We don't know what happened, though, between them. All we know is that she is now on her way to Sweden to see her fiance, and he fiance
Oh, they're
she's
married, aren't they married?
I guess they're married. Are
Yeah.
they married? Maybe I
Yes.
missed that. All right, so they're already married, so that's a problem. Anyway, he says to her, "What's the matter?" She says to him, "What's the matter?" "Nothing," I said. "Be glad you're going to Sweden." "I am," she says, and this is the most devastating line of dialogue. One of the most devastating in this entire collection, which is like 600 pages of bold stories. But she says, "I am. His vitality is fantastic, don't you agree? A prisoner of war for 3 years in Russia, that hair-raising escape, and now he's in Sweden lecturing on Rubens." I'm just like, this guy can't win. He's like, he's a schlub who's been injured in the war, but not a prisoner of war, not a war hero, did not engage in a hair-raising escape, and is now not for sure lecturing on Rubens in Sweden, right? So it's a, you know, it's, I mean, we just, you, you, The Elsa Bascalet story is not funny, although I'm sure we could find some funny things in it. Parting is hilarious in its devastation. So I always laugh when I get to that line. And he says, fantastic, it really is. And she says, you must get busy too. Get your degree at least. And then he says, shouts, oh, shut up. What? She asked, horrified. What? She had gone quite pale. Forgive me, I whispered. I mean my leg. I talk to it sometimes. And then this is what this also makes me laugh. I mean, she didn't look, it's just like this line of thought, you know, that isn't shared, but he says to himself, she didn't look in the least like Rubens. She looked more like Picasso. And I kept wondering why on earth he had married her. She wasn't even pretty, and I loved her. For some reason, I refuse to acknowledge that they're married. They are married. But, you know, and then he just has this way, and this is a tiny little story, right? I mean, you think of like those early Hemingway stories that are so tiny, and yet you see them, you know, and I think that I don't think there's any question that these early Bull stories, and in really all, you know, throughout Bull's career was em influenced by Hemingway's ability to, you know, give us a scene and dialogue in very few lines, right? But he says this, it was quieter now on the platform. Everyone had got onto the train. A few people stood around seeing their friends off. Any moment now, the voice would say the train was leaving. Any moment might be the last. It still hasn't happened yet. We're still in that moment before the train has left because, you know, it's a moment that goes on and on. And he argues with himself some more. Sorry.
No, I was going to say the part before all this where he says, I recall the smell of soap and coffee, and I felt utterly wretched. For a moment, a desperate courage filled me. I wanted to drag this little person out of the window and keep her here, for she was mine. I loved her. And then the, what's the matter? Nothing. Be glad you're going to Sweden. I am, you know. So he's really going through a lot, just standing there. We're learning that they've known each other a long time. This was a very brief visit, because she says, it was really nice of you to stop by on your way. You know, so it's just a very, very brief encounter, very, very brief visit, but they have history, obviously. And then, you know, and he acknowledges that she's not a Rubens, she's a Picasso, but you know, she's not even pretty, but he loves her. And he says she was the very opposite of Rubens, slim, long-legged, high-strung, and she was as old as the Russian Revolution, as old as the hunger and dirt in Europe, as old as the war. I love that. I don't know why, but I love it.
And it, you know, it that's common. There's an echo of that, as old as the hunger and dirt in Europe, as old as the war. It's a kind of a refrain
Yeah.
that comes earlier. Yes, I feel a bit sh ashamed. This has become part of our life, really, the dirt and rags and ruins. And I feel a bit ashamed. I feel like a deserter. You already said
Yeah.
that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, I think the lyricism is just indisputable
Yeah.
here, but also really just such a tiny, tiny light touch.
And then the rest is really almost all dialogue. I can't believe it, Sweden. It's like a dream. It is all a dream. Do you think so? Of course, 15 years, 30 years, another 30 years. Why bother about a degree? It's not worth the effort. Be quiet, damn you.
You talking to your leg? Yes. What does it say? And this is also one of the most, I mean, this is such a risky moment because, again, like in the Bascalite story, there's moments of like, he goes to the very edge of cheesiness, right? So at this moment, she says, are you talking to your leg? Yes. What does it say?
But can I say something? The fact that she says, what does it say? And she's playing along. I think that one line, what does it say? It says so much about their relationship or their friendship or the way they joke around or the way they know each other. Like she just falls into it. All right, what does it say? Yeah.
100%. You're right. You're right. And that's Like the pause on that is so important. And I would just add to that that she wasn't really playing along before. So the
Yes.
moment itself has sort of, because it has keeps lasting,
Yeah.
she's realizing she really does love him,
Yeah.
she wants to hear what is presumed in this tiny scene, tiny moment.
Yes. What are his emotions really about? Right? Like, that's what she is sort of asking there. Not about
Yeah,
his leg, but
sure. But
what
like you
does he
said, I
really.
think what you
Yeah.
said earlier, she's playing around because
Yeah.
she loves him. But she's also married and going to Sweden, and you can't, both things can be true, And so we were quiet. We were quite silent. We looked at one another and smiled, and we told one another without saying a word. I mean, there it is. But again, is that borderline cheesy? I would argue it is. But I think I agree with you. What surrounds the context of the moment aren't cheesy, and therefore he gets away with it.
Yeah, because the very next line pulls it out of cheesy for me.
You want to read it?
She smiled at me. Do you understand now? Is it all right? Yes. Truly? Yes. You see, she went on softly, it's not important to be together and all that. That's not what really matters, is it?
I mean, of course it is. It's ridiculous. So, do people say that? Of course they do. And so it's like, but I mean, she just squashed him with her foot.
It's like we don't have to be together to love each other. We
Yeah.
don't, I can have my life, you can have your life,
Yeah,
and we still have.
I'm going to Sweden.
Oh, you should read the rest.
Voice that announces the train departures was right above me now, official, distinct. And Bo is so great on officialness, officiousness, he's so great on that. And his narrators are often like, fuck that shit, but the voice that announces the train departures was right above me now, official, distinct. And I winced as if a great gray impersonal whip had come swishing down under the vaulted roof. Goodbye. Goodbye. Very slowly, the train started to move, sliding away in the darkness under the great roof.
That's the parting. That is not cheesy.
I just think the fact that he becomes dangerously close is the beauty of it. I can see him just crying for his people, and I
Yeah.
think, and again, he was such a engaged person. Politically and otherwise, and so I could see him just feeling like, this could be a better place if if we're decent to each other.
Heinrich Böll is the author of The Death of Elsa Baskalight and Parting. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.